this Christmas. I think of the word wonderful. We talk about how Christmas is the most wonderful time of the year. What does wonderful mean? It means full of wonder. And when we begin Christmas as a kid, isn't Christmas full of wonder? You are so excited to open the presents. You're excited to go down and see what was left and how much of the cookies and milk had been drunk the night before. And you're excited. It's all magical. It's wonderful. Even the story of this baby being born and why there are wise men and why there are shepherds and there's angels. All of that is wonderful to us. But I'm afraid that as we get older, sometimes we lose the wonder of Christmas. We lose the wonder. Christmas becomes more about, can we afford that? Can we get together with our family? How much time will I get off of work? And instead of Christmas being the most wonderful time of the year, often Christmas becomes the busiest time of the year. And sometimes the most stressful time of the year. However, what I want to do this Christmas season is I want us to look at a series we're going to call The Overlooked Characters of Christmas. And I want, as we look at characters who are overlooked or misunderstood over the next several weeks, I hope we will see the Christmas story from a new vantage point. And it will fill us with wonder again. And that this Christmas will be the most wonderful Christmas in your life. And so as we begin this series, I want you to turn to Matthew chapter 1. And on the very first page of the New Testament, we want to begin where the Bible begins. Matthew's writing to the Jewish world and to the world at large to tell them who Jesus is. And where does he begin the Christmas story? He begins with a genealogy, a family tree. But I don't know about you, but when I get to the genealogies in my Bible reading time, I pick up my pace a little bit sometimes. I just kind of overlook and just these are just names on a list. I don't think about them. But Matthew is doing something very important. As he is showing the world who Jesus is, he begins by giving us his family tree. And we shouldn't overlook it. And so I thought this morning, as I was thinking about this genealogy, I thought, you know, it's one thing to read it, but how much more fun would it be to sing the genealogy? But then I realized I'm the worst singer in the church. And so I asked Ronnie if he would sing the genealogy for us. And this is going to be impressive. Well done. Well done. There will be a quiz next week as we'll be opening our song with that. Oh, man, that's so fun. But you know those names are not there for no reason. They're there for a particular purpose. And I want us to learn from that family tree this morning. Three things I want us to learn from the family tree of Jesus. Three things. We begin in verse 1 and we see this. Matthew opens the New Testament this way. This is the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And the first thing we learn from this story of names is that Jesus is fully human, or fully God and fully human. Jesus is fully God and fully human. He's fully God and he's fully human. Why is Matthew giving us this genealogy? Why is he teaching us about Jesus' ancestors? Because he is showing us that Jesus is not some hologram that just appeared on the scene. When God wanted to save us, he did not send a hologram of his son, but he sent a fully God, fully human Messiah. Here's why this is important. Matthew wants us to know that Jesus is fully human, where he can be our substitute. This is what theologians call the doctrine of the incarnation. The doctrine of the incarnation, what that means is that God put on flesh. So the first thing we learn in this genealogy, it's really important for us to understand this Christmas, is when God was wanting to save his people, he did not send a representative. He did not just send the captain of the army. He did not send an angel. He sent his own son to come and rescue us. But sometimes we get to thinking about this, and Christians wrongly will think, well, Jesus is 50% God, 50% man. That's 100% wrong, right? Jesus is 100% God, and he is 100% man. Here's what this means. Jesus is not 1 ounce less of God than God the Father. He is just as much God as God the Father. And it also means that Jesus is just as much human as you. Jesus is 100% God. He's 100% man. And this is incredible. Think about this for a moment. Let the wonder of this get your attention. This Christmas season, we are not celebrating an angel that has come to save us. We are not celebrating some designated hero of Israel. We are celebrating that God himself became a man to rescue us from our sin. My goodness. I mean, can you imagine if you were in bad shape and the president of the United States, it garnered his attention to come rescue you himself. He didn't send his troops. He came himself to rescue you. What we are saying is you are so valuable to God that he did not send anyone other than his own son to come to your rescue. That's how much he cares about you. That's what Christmas is teaching us, that Jesus is fully God but fully man. Because he wanted to substitute in the place of humanity. Here's how one ancient thinker, Augustine of Hippo, wrote in the 5th century about this. Here's what Augustine said. He said, man's maker was made man. Man's maker was made man, that he, ruler of the stars, might nurse at his mother's breast, that the bread of life might hunger, that the fountain of living water might thirst, that the light of this world sleep, and the way be tired on his journey, and the truth might be accused of false witness, that the teacher might be beaten with whips, the foundation be suspended on wood, that strength might grow weak, and that the healer might be wounded, that life might die. That doesn't fill you with wonder, I don't know what will. That God himself sent his son, the very God of very God, fully man, to come in our place. What's going on in that cute nativity scene is not just a story to warm our hearts, but it is God come to the rescue of helpless, hopeless humanity. It should fill us with wonder. Three things we learn from this. First, is that Jesus is fully God and fully human. That we have a divine rescuer who came as 100% God and 100% man. The second thing that we learn is in the second part of that verse. It says, the book of genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. What we learn here is when it says he's the son of David and the son of Abraham, that Jesus is the long-awaited Messiah. He's the long-awaited Messiah. Why does it say he's the son of Abraham? Well, you see, God promises Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. He says, Abraham, I'm going to make you a great nation. And from you, I'm going to make a great family. Well, that would make sense if he had a lot of children, but when God promises to Abraham that he's going to have this family, Abraham didn't have any children and he was old. But he promises to Abraham that he will have children. And he takes Abraham outside and he says, Abraham, I want you to look up at the stars. Abraham, do you see the stars out there? I want you to start counting them. I don't know how far Abraham counted, but he got to some point and God says, listen, Abraham, your family is going to be more than the number of the stars. It's almost an impossible promise. And he says that one of his heirs, that the family, he's going to create this family so great that there's going to be a family that are the children of Abraham from every tribe, tongue, and nation. And this family is going to bless every family on the planet. He makes that promise to Abraham. And Israel was counting on that promise. And they were looking for the fulfillment of that promise. And then he says he's the son of David. You remember in 2 Samuel chapter 7, God calls David to be the king over Israel. Saul had been a terrible king. God chose David to be king. And when he chose David to be king, he makes a promise to David. And it seems to be an impossible promise. It seems to be hyperbolic. He says to David, "One day, David, one of your heirs, one of your descendants is going to sit on the throne forever and is never going to leave it." Well, maybe people thought this is hyperbolic, that, I mean, it's just saying he's going to reign for a long time. I mean, after all kingdoms come to an end. But God is promising in the Old Testament that there will be a king who will reign over the world forever, and his kingdom will have no end. And so the Israelites knew this. And so when Matthew opens the pages of the New Testament, he says, well, let me tell you who Jesus Christ is. He's fully God. He's fully man. And let me tell you who he is. He is the son of Abraham. Who's going to be the one who creates a family with as many descendants as the stars? This baby in the manger. Who is going to be the one who sits on the throne forever? This baby in the manger. How is God going to keep his promise to David? How is he going to keep his promise to Abraham? Well, look in this manger. And then you begin to ask, well, Matthew, how are we supposed to know that Jesus is the rightful heir of Abraham and the rightful heir of David? How do we know that he really is the one you say he is? He says, well, let's check his genealogy. Let's check his genealogy. And what he's going to do is he's going to take Jesus' genealogy back to King David and show that Jesus is the rightful heir to David's throne. And then he's going to go back behind David and he's going to trace it back, as Ronnie's saying, he began with Abraham. Why? Because he is saying all the way back to Abraham. How is God answering his promise to Abraham? How is he answering his promise to David? Through the birth of this baby, Jesus Christ. And so as he begins to tell this story, we should be filled with wonder that the way that God is answering his promises is not with an army. The way God is answering his promises is not with a legion of angels. He's answering his promise with the birth of a baby. So that's the second thing that should fill us with wonder. But we learn one other thing, and where I want to spend most of our time this morning, is that in this family tree, there are some surprising people. There are some surprising people in Jesus' family tree. Point three, Jesus has surprising people in his family tree. Now, if we're all honest, we all have somebody in our family tree that we're not the most proud of. We all have that weird uncle, that weird aunt, or something like that. We all have somebody in that family. If you're thinking, I don't have anybody in that family, I have bad news for you. It might be you. I'm just kidding. Now, some of you are like, man, I really got to think about this. All right. But here's the thing. Jesus has surprising people in his family. He has people who show up in his family tree that you would not expect. There are names that seem to be out of place. And there are four names in particular. As Ronnie's saying a lot of names, what I want to do is focus on four of them as we walk through this. There are four names that you wouldn't expect. There are four names of women. Women. They didn't appear in genealogies in the ancient Near East. After all, it wasn't a woman's name was not enough to establish the authority. After all, what is Matthew trying to establish? That Jesus is the rightful king over Israel and the world. And he's given the genealogy to show that Jesus is the rightful king, and yet he's including women. Why? Why? Because they have a special place in this story. These, if you will, are the grandmothers of Jesus. These are the grandmothers of Jesus back in his story. And we have four of them that are pointed out to us. And they're surprising. Each of them are interesting because, you see, not only are these women These are women with scandal. One writer says that each of these names, when they would have been read aloud in the Jewish synagogue, the good Jewish people would have cringed at their names a little bit out of embarrassment. That they have an asterisk beside their name. These were not the women that you put forward for your kids to grow up and be like in Israel. They were scandalous names, but yet they show up in Jesus' family tree. Well, who are these women? Who are these grandmothers of Jesus? Let's stop and look at these grandmothers together. Verse 2, Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah. So, tracking with me, Abraham had Isaac, Isaac has Jacob, and Jacob has Judah, and Judah's the brother of Joseph, if you know that story. If I were writing that story, I would have thought, man, I would think Jesus would come through Joseph's line, but that's not the way that God did it. He came through Judah's line, and God promises that one day Judah's descendant would sit on the throne. But it says here, Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, by Tamar. Tamar, the first grandmother of Jesus that we meet. One writer said this way, we can think of Tamar as the forgotten. The forgotten Tamar. And I want to tell you a little bit about Tamar and how she shows up in Jesus' family tree. It's a name that many Jewish people would have liked to have forgotten. This is back in Genesis. It's before the people of God are enslaved in Egypt. Tamar marries Judah's son named Ur. Okay? Not on the top name list, right? Ur. Okay? So Ur, she marries him. And Ur, you have to understand, is the product of Judah having an affair with a Canaanite woman. So Judah has an affair with a Canaanite woman, has a son named Ur. She marries this son of the Canaanite woman in Judah. Well, he's not a very good man, and he dies. Bible says God takes him out. And so God takes out this man, her husband. And so in Jewish custom, the thing that the dad of the guy who just died was supposed to do was give his next oldest son to the wife to marry her. So Tamar then married Onan. Again, not on the top of the name list this year. So Onan and Ur, she married him. And you know what happened to him? He died. And so Judah's thinking, I'm not so sure I want to give her another son. Not going well, not a great track record here. And so he withholds that, and you have to understand that's really important. He has a younger son. She waits for years. I mean, Judah never gives the son. And then in a weird turn of events, Tamar dresses up like a harlot and goes and stands on the side of the road and waits for her father-in-law to come. The father-in-law goes to her. Judah, we know he has some sin in his past with his affair. She waits for him to come, and he doesn't recognize her. But he takes Tamar to his bed, not knowing that it's his daughter-in-law, and she gets pregnant. And he never realizes it's her. But then a few months later, he finds out that Tamar's pregnant, and he wants to put her to death because she's been unfaithful to his family. But she has a way to prove through this thing that it's actually his baby. And she proves to him that it's actually his baby that she's pregnant with. So he relents and does not kill her. I don't know about you, but that reminds me of Jerry Springer. And the father is you, Judah. It's this big reveal. So here's the thing that's going on there. It is completely scandalous. I can't tell you who's right and who's good in that situation, because I don't think anyone wants. But here's what I do know. This is Jesus' family. You may think your family's messed up. Good news. Even Jesus has had messed up people in his family. Here's what I want you to know. Here's what we can learn from this story that's so important. That God, through Tamar, being included in this family line, we can learn that God can take a broken story and turn it into something beautiful for His glory. Something so messed up like that was what God used to bring about the Messiah. When I was a young boy, about 6 years old, I remember going to church and feeling something for the first time. Shame. Because you see, my parents were married to previous people. They were both had previous marriages before they got married and had me. And they had been divorced. And I grew up in a church where that was very much a stigma. And I remember being 5 or 6 in a Sunday school class when someone said to me, "Oh, but your parents are divorced. We're divorced." And I remember feeling like a second-class person in the church because of my parents' baggage. I carried that with me for years. That I didn't really have a place at the table. I was welcome, but I wasn't really welcome because of my parents' past. I want you to know something. Very clearly, we all have brokenness in our lives and in our families, but there are no second-class citizens in the family of God. Your story may come from broken beginnings. But you're in good company, because the story of our Messiah has someone like Tamar in it. Here's what I want you to know. God can turn your broken story into something beautiful for His glory. I don't care if you're on your third marriage, fifth marriage. God can turn your broken story into something beautiful for His glory. But we don't just learn about Tamar. We find some other grandmothers of Jesus. The story continues. And Hezron, the father of Ram. And Ram, the father of Amminadab. And Amminadab, the father of Nashon. Which the song ride, Amminadab, who was then the dad, which is pretty clever. The father of Nashon. And Nashon, the father of Salmon. And Salmon, the father of Boaz by Rahab. We find the next mother of Jesus, which we could call the sinful, the forgotten Tamar, the sinner Rahab. Rahab's story is very interesting. See, Rahab was a little bit later in the story. The people of God had been in Egypt. They'd been rescued out of Egypt, and they were going to the promised land. And the spies went ahead into Jericho. You remember the walls around Jericho? They went into Jericho, this fortified city, to try to understand what was going on. The spies went in. It looks like they may get caught. But there's a woman who says, "Come on in. Come on in. I'll protect you. I'll protect you." And she gave them critical military intelligence. She protected them. But the odd thing was her occupation. She was a prostitute. We don't know if it was by her own choice or something she was pulled into, but she had been part of a sinful lifestyle for a long time. Yet God had used her to save His people and ultimately deliver on His promise to get them to the promised land. I don't know, but I think when we realize that Rahab, this woman who had been so involved in sexual sin, can be used by God so mightily to even rescue the people of God, and that this woman who had spent these years being used by men had now found her Savior who loved her. My goodness. What this teaches us through this grandmother of Jesus, Rahab, is that no one is too sinful for God to save. No one is too sinful for God to save. The other aspect of that is none of your past disqualifies you to be used by God. None of your past, no matter what it was, God can still use you. God can still use you. That's what we see in Rahab. But she's not the last one. Rahab also has a daughter-in-law. See, and we see Boaz, the father of Obed, by Ruth. By Ruth. Her daughter-in-law was a woman named Ruth. And we'll call her the outsider. The outsider. You see, Ruth was a Moabite woman. Moabites were those who came from Lot's family, and they were known as the people who were cursed by God. If you can think of the worst people in the world, it was the Moabites. They were cursed by God. They lived in the desert. Things weren't good. But at one point, a famine came in the land of Israel, and a woman named Naomi and her family went to Moab looking for food. While they were there, her sons married two Moabite women. And one of the men married a woman named Ruth. Ruth watched her mother-in-law. She saw her mother-in-law believe in the true God of the Scripture, and she trusted in the God of her mother-in-law. And she even went back to Israel after her husband died, and she went back to Israel with her mother-in-law, where she found a kinsman redeemer named Boaz, the son of Rahab, who apparently had a heart for broken outsiders because of his mother, and he cared, and he married Ruth, this one who was a scandalous outsider, who grew up, think about this, y'all, this is one of the grandmothers of Jesus. Ruth grew up worshiping false gods. Not just that she didn't go to church. She grew up worshiping false gods. Yet God took an outsider, an enemy, and he brought her near and made her one of the grandmothers of Jesus and the great-grandmother of King David. Here's the thing we learn from Ruth, is it doesn't matter how you were raised, once God gets a hold of your life, he can use you mightily for his glory. Some of you grew up in church, praise God for that. Some of y'all came to church for the first time this week. It doesn't matter. God can still use your life mightily for his glory. So we see the forgotten, the sinful, the outsider. And lastly, we'll see the exploited Bathsheba. And Jesse, verse 6, the father of David, the king. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. One of the grandmothers of Jesus, if you didn't know, was Bathsheba. If you know any stories from the Old Testament, you probably know this one, David and Bathsheba. But we often think of the story from David's perspective. But I want you to imagine the story from a different perspective this morning, the perspective of Bathsheba. Bathsheba married Uriah. Uriah was one of David's closest military warriors. He was one of what was called his mighty men. Uriah was one of David's go-to men in the kingdom. She was married to him. And one day, she was taking a bath, and the king spotted her, sent for her to come to him, and he took her to his bed, impregnated her. And then, when the scandal was coming out, he then ordered her husband out on the battlefield and set him up to be killed. And then he took her as his wife. So think about what's going on for her. She's married. Things are good. She gets taken in with the king. She gets pregnant by a man who's not her husband. And then her husband, her king kills her husband. And then she has to marry the man who just killed her husband. And her family doesn't like it. Her grandfather will eventually rise up and try to overthrow David. Family doesn't like it. David, though, it's not a great love story because David, he takes on other wives. And David has other women that he's involved with. It's not a pretty picture. Bathsheba is exploited. She's used. Her life is ruined. Her husband gone. She's now married to a new husband that's unfaithful. Her grandfather's trying to kill her husband. It's not a pretty picture for Bathsheba. But it's a realistic picture of life. Because you see, God is using her pain to bring about his purposes. You see, in our suffering, I want you to know you do not suffer for just an arbitrary reason, but every suffering is used for the glory of God somehow. And I want you to know that he was using her pain to bring about his purposes. And what we learn from Bathsheba is this, that those who've been exploited, those who've been abused, those who've been used, those who have been taken advantage of, can find a new identity in the family of God and in Jesus Christ. Some of y'all I know have had some of those experiences. And I want you to know you can find a new identity in Jesus. Because you see, what we find about Bathsheba, the thing that she is here remembered in the New Testament for, is not the sinfulness. It's that she is the grandmother of Jesus. She is one of the women in his line. We learn some important things in this family tree. These surprising grandmothers of Jesus. In Tamar, we learn that God can turn a broken story into something beautiful for his glory. In Rahab, we learn that no one is too far gone. No one's past is too sinful for God to work in their lives. Through Ruth, we learn that God can even use outsiders and those who grew up outside of the church for his glory. We learn through Bathsheba that those who are exploited, those who are used, that God can turn their suffering into something beautiful for his purposes. We learn in these stories, in the real parts of life, that God is at work behind the scenes. You see, if you could have had a conversation with Tamar, I don't think she could have believed that through that encounter on the side of the road, that was going to lead towards the Messiah. I don't think that Ruth, or that Rahab, when she was living her life in prostitution, could have ever thought that the king of the world would be born in her line. I don't think that Ruth, when she was a Moabite woman, could have ever imagined that the Messiah would come through her. And I don't think that Bathsheba, in that brokenness, could have ever imagined what God was going to do with her story. And what I want you to know is, as dark sometimes as it feels in your family, I want you to know God is at work behind the scenes. You may not be able to see what he is doing, but I want you to know God is up to something in your families. So we learn a lot from these surprising people in Jesus' family tree. But we also learn it's messy and that God can use the mess of our families to bring about his purposes. And then the story continues. I'll read the rest of the names. Verse 7, and Solomon, the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam, the father of Abijah, and Abijah, the father of Asaph, and Asaph, the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat, the father of Joram, and Joram, the father of Uzziah, and Uzziah, the father of Jotham, and Jotham, the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah, the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh, the father of Amos, and Amos, the father of Josiah, and Josiah, the father of Jeconiah, and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. And after the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel, the father of Abiud, and Abiud, the father of Eliakim, and Eliakim, the father of Azor, and Azor the father of Zadok, and Zadok the father of Achim, and Achim the father of Eliad, and Eliad the father of Eleazar, and Eleazar the father of Mathan, and Mathan the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon were 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations. This is Jesus' family tree. It's filled with some weird, strange people. So my question to you this morning is simple. What makes Christmas so wonderful? Well, Matthew thinks we need to know the backstory. We need to know the backstory to this. Imagine the nativity scene. Baby Jesus, Mary and Joseph, shepherds, angels, the inn off in the distance, the cries of the noisy animals, the nativity scene that we always think of. What's going on in that manger that makes Christmas so wonderful? Full of wonder. What's going on in that manger? Well, Matthew tells us we have to know the backstory. He says, you'd be mistaken if you thought that was a mere ordinary baby. That baby is fully God and fully human. The one who can rescue the world. In that manger in the nativity scene, is not just any baby. That baby, Matthew tells us, is the son of Abraham. And that through him, he is going to create the greatest family this world has ever seen. And that his descendants will be as numerous as the stars. You see, the glory of Christmas isn't just that Jesus is the son of Abraham, but that he came to make you a son or daughter of Abraham. You see, what he is doing, he's saying, I'm creating a family, and God has promised a family to Abraham, and how am I going to create his family? Is I'm going to take you and you and you and you and adopt you into my family. You know the song, Father Abraham had many sons. Wait, what do you say? I'm one of them, and so are you. Why do we sing that? Because what we are saying is Jesus has created a whole new family with as many descendants as the stars. And who are those descendants? It's you and me and all of those who have trusted in Christ. Why is Christmas so wonderful? Because we get to be part of the family of God because the son of Abraham was born in the manger. But he's also the son of David. Jesus is the rightful heir to the Davidic throne. He is the king of this world. And of his rule, there will be no end. What they are saying is, as you look in that cute little baby scene, it's cute, but it's God's act of war against Satan and his enemies. Jesus comes for battle. And we know on Easter morning how that battle ends, don't we? You see, the good news is that Jesus came as the rightful Davidic king. But the wonderful part of Christmas is he came to be your king. He came to be the king of your heart, the king of your life, as he rules and reigns forever. That's so wonderful this Christmas. But the other thing that's so wonderful is that there are surprising people in Jesus' family tree. Matthew tells us of these people that the Jewish people would have been ashamed of or embarrassed by. He tells us of their story. As he says, hey, you see this baby? Let me tell you about his ancestors. Let me tell you about some of the grandmothers in his life, some of the brokenness of the people in his life. But you see, that baby would grow up. That baby would grow up. He would live a perfect life. And then he would go to the cross. Go to the cross. At Christmas, we think about trees a lot, don't we? We think about trees a lot. We all put up our trees. Maybe you put up your tree this weekend. Or maybe you're like my family and put it up 3 weeks ago. But we think about trees a lot. You know, one of the ways we talk about the cross of Jesus is as a tree. At Calvary. And we think about the cross, we think about different things. But I want to give you a little insight into how I think Jesus thought of the cross. I think when Jesus saw the cross, he saw it as his family tree. He saw it as his family tree. Because Jesus was tasked by the Father to go and rescue his family. People like Tamar, who were forgotten, caught up in crazy sinful behavior. Rahab, big sinners. Outsiders like Ruth, those like Bathsheba. I think Jesus saw the cross as his family tree. I've got to go there to get my family. I've got to go there to get all of those people who are going to be like Tamar, Ruth, Rahab, and Bathsheba. I've got to go to that family tree, and I have to go die in their place that they can become my brothers and sisters forever. You see, the cross for Jesus is a family tree where he goes and he dies in the place of his family that they might be adopted by God. And here is the good news that I find so wonderful this Christmas season is Jesus isn't embarrassed or ashamed of anyone in his family. He says, look what I did to purchase you. You are my prized possession. You see, Jesus surprising people in his family tree isn't just Tamar. It's not just Rahab. It's not just Ruth. And it's not just Bathsheba. The most surprising people in Jesus' family is you and me. Because he took sinners like us. He went to the cross. He died in our place that we might have a new place in the family of God. Because you see, Jesus really is the son of Abraham, who's called to make his descendants as numerous as the stars. And he does through his family tree on the cross. And so this morning, I want you to know, the story of Christmas is even better than a Hallmark movie. It's even better than a Hallmark movie. It's not just sweet and make you feel warm inside. The story of Christmas might just save your soul. Let's pray together.